Okay, here we are. It's the next party roundtable discussion. You laughing?
I was just laughing. So anyway, I was thinking of something. Well, this is Jason Rob.
You're thinking.
I was thinking.
That's a good point.
This is Jason Rob.
Yeah,
I'm Thomas Rob.
And nice party roundtable.
And I guess something is funny. I don't know.
Funny. Nice party roundtable.
But it's February 21st.
Yeah, all the interesting things going on here.
February 21st. Yeah, interesting things. And some things are like really funny, and some things are not so funny. So,
well, first off, people always like to know kind of what goes on around here at headquarters, the Knights Party. And of course, Dad, you and Rachel recently just got back from Washington D.C. You attended Willis Cardinal's funeral. Is that correct? Kind of tell the listeners about that. That's a little bit about Willis Cardinal.
A lot of people don't know.
Some people may not know about Willis Cardinal, so they may want to say who Willis Cardinal was.
And then
about you and Rachel going out there.
Well, I think it was interesting. Before I tell you about Willis Cardinal, for a national Klan leader to be speaking at Arlington National Cemetery, some people might find those odd too, you know. I did speak at Willis Cardinal's funeral at the Arlington National Cemetery. That's quite a honor for a person to be buried there. But Willis Cardinal, it was 89 years old when he passed away. He'd been written up as the most prominent leader or mover and shaker in the white nationalist movement in 50 years. And a lot of people hadn't heard of him because he was a man that worked kind of behind the scenes. He was kind of reclusive, didn't demand a lot of personal attention, but he was nevertheless a mover and shaker in the white nationalist movement for 50 years or longer.
Newspaper and book publisher.
Over 50 years, because I've been involved in ministry for 50 years, and he was doing stuff long before I got married. So 60 years at least, maybe even a little more than that, ever since he was a young man. So
name some of the different past associates of his.
Well, the first time I ever heard of him was before I got married. And I was in high school, and Kenneth Goff spoke in Tucson, Arizona. And I'm trying to remember exactly when it was, but it was before I got married, I believe. It might have been right after I got married. I'm not really sure now. At the Pennington Room in... at a hotel. I remember the Pennington Room. I can't remember the name of the hotel, but I do remember the Pennington Room. And he was talking about the Liberty Lobby and the Liberty Letter being published in Washington, D.C., and that was the publication of Willis Cardinal. And this is going back 50 years, and he was active prior to that. He published the American Free Press when he was passed away. The Spotlight, the Barnes Review. He organized the Institute of Historical Review. He was an organizer and
helped
create the Populist Party. He was a backer of David Duke in a run for the Senate in Louisiana. He organized the Youth for Wallace campaigns back in the 60s.
Protests and demonstrations against the Holocaust Museum when it first opened up.
Yes,
D.C.
Absolutely. He was a man who really had his fingers in a lot of different things. And anything that he thought could help advance our cause, he jumped into it and did what he could, not for personal glory or personal limelight, but because his ability to bring people together and work across the aisle,
right.
So to speak. Yeah. I guess, you know, and... So he was, and when he died, this was a big deal because New York Times even ran a long article about this man being buried in Arlington, how shocking it was. So he wasn't a nobody.
Right.
And New York Times, it was just 2 days ago, wasn't it, Rachel?
No,
3 days ago.
At the time of his death, Huffington Post, when they had learned that he would be buried there, ran a scathing diatribe against him.
Yes. Huffington Post. So he did demand attention. And then, like I said, New York Times, after his funeral, they ran an article just a couple of days ago. another scathing article about how dare Arlington National Cemetery give honors to this man. And
even though he served in the military.
Served in the military and got a Purple Heart, absolutely. And so he was buried there on Wednesday, the 17th of March. Rachel and I flew out there. We flew out Tuesday morning, left early from the Springfield Airport in Springfield, Missouri. Got in Chicago, then flew into D.C., got there not late Tuesday evening, but nevertheless, by the time we got from the airport and got the car and got to the motel room, and we're up 6:30, 7 o'clock. So the day was over. And then we got the next morning. We went to down to the Capitol. We took copies of the Crusader newspaper, and we distributed those at some different congressional offices there. Did that for a couple hours. We were able to get, while in D.C., we're able to get an opportunity to do make a short little video clip in front of the Capitol. We did get over there then to the cemetery in time for the funeral, and met in a room, met some old friends I've known for years, some of them I haven't seen in several years. It was kind of a it was kind of like a family and friends only invitation, so it was not like put out to be like a lot of people. And I find that really kind of humorous, because the New York Times article, they kind of made fun that he only had like a smithereen of people, where at the same time some Jewish person was being buried there also, and how the huge number of attendance he had, but Willa Carter only had a few people there. That's because only family and friends were invited.
Yeah, it wasn't open to the general public.
Right, you know. Right. And but anyway, just a few family and friends were invited.
It was more of an intimate.
Absolutely. Event. That's all it was intended to be.
And if it was open to the public, there probably would have been hundreds and hundreds of people.
There probably would have been a lot more people, that's for sure.
So the fact is, it was very intimate, just for family and friends.
And so they collected full military honors. With the gun salute and the chaplain and the honor guard, very nicely, as of course you'd expect Arlington to do. And then after the military concluded their portion of the ceremony, then it was turned over to me, and I finished up with the civilian portion of the ceremony. And a longtime friend associate, Willis Carto, Stanley Rittenhouser, gave a few words of his long life friendship with Willis Carto, and then I finished with a eulogy and then a prayer, and then an individual sang Amazing Grace. And this fellow was a retired Washington, D.C. police officer, and he sang Amazing Grace, and then the ceremony was over.
And that's a big honor for the Carto family requesting you to be, the basic providing the service for the civilian portion of it. That's a really huge honor. And of course, you've been friends with the Carto family, for at least the '80s.
A long time.
I mean, it's a very long time. And so the fact that you and Rachel were able to, fly up there, and be considered part of the family and close friends, that really says a lot.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned all the different things, that Willis has done over the years. And, we mentioned his wife, Elizabeth, also, who has been there with him in the trenches throughout that whole time, working and helping him on all his projects, very instrumental with the Barnes Review, and it was really nice to see her there. She's a really remarkable woman herself, and she will be, when the time comes, she will be buried alongside Willis in Arlington Cemetery also.
Yes, yeah. And she's a very dignified, stately woman. And
that always... Whenever you see, for the most part, when you see someone that's been dedicated, like Willis Carto, sometimes the spouse, the wife, is not given the due credit as much, and it's a team effort, it's a family effort, and anyone that's been involved in the racialist movement such as Willis Cardo, you have to have that family involvement, you know, and the involvement from your spouse. And, you know, Elizabeth, kind of like the unsung hero,
yeah,
you know, because Willis could not have been as successful and have gone as far if it wasn't for a spouse that was 100% behind him, you know, saying, hey, you can do this, you can do that, or giving him ideas and stuff like that, because it's a team effort.
Yeah.
You know?
And I know he relied on her a lot for advice and counsel you know, leadership role that she played.
Yeah.
And yet she never took the, try to take the limelight. I remember here a couple years ago when they were out here. I can't remember the incident, but I know something. You asked Elizabeth to say a few words or something like that, and she said no. She said Willis is the one that, you know, is the one that deserves the recognition, you know, but she does too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, and I just like hearing her talk because she's born in Germany and still has a very thick German accent,
right?
So
and very smart lady.
Yeah. Oh yeah,
I mean very smart.
You know?
Yeah. And like you said, real refined. And so it's really...
People would actually go, if they're interested, I know they can find it on the internet. I can't tell how to do it, but maybe Rachel would know, or Jason. But about 2008, there was a biography written about Willis Cardo, titled Willis Cardo and the American Far Right. Willis Cardo and the American Far Right. And if anybody has any interest in the history of the white nationalist movement, you know, they might be listening to our program here, but they really have an interest in the movement as a whole. I would suggest you go on the internet, and I know you can find the book. I know it's going to be out there. And read it. Willis Cardo, the American Far Right. He was a socialist. Charles Colvin and
Yockley.
Francis Parker Yockey and Ezra Pound, Eustace Mullins, a lot of these names.
Think that the Barnes Review may sell that book.
Probably does. Yeah, it probably does.
So you can probably go to the Barnes Review website and get that book there.
But again, I know most people are just going to listen to this, and oh, that's very interesting. But some of you people are going to say, well, I really want to know more about this guy.
Oh.
You know, and so that would be a good opportunity to get that.
Well, I remember, really the first time I really remember hearing the name of Willis Cardo. Of course, I'm 42, but I remember it would have been in the 80s. And I can't remember, but it was a yearly meeting in Missouri. And all I remember is it was, part of the meeting was outside, and there was a long row of like tables.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was not Lincoln, Missouri, or...
The person you're referring to held meetings in Lincoln, Missouri, and also up in Illinois.
Yeah,
but
it was one of those.
What was the guy's name?
But anyway, it was...
John Harrell.
Yeah.
John Harrell. Yeah. I just remember...
Is there be like
a long row?
Yeah, miniature tables.
Yeah, it was a permanent fixture of like wood tables,
right?
You know, because they had it every year.
Yeah, there might have been of course that's a long time ago.
Right.
But in my memory, and it could have been less, but at the time it seems to me like, you know, it could have been 50, 60.
Yeah, long tables.
Is that right?
And it was just a lot. And I remember, and this was like, I don't know, I want to say the early 80s. Mid 80s. I was born in 74, so, you know,
83,
yeah, so I would have been 8, 9, 10 years old.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I mean I still remember to this day, you know, the long row, and I remember, cuz I even at that time, you know, just how we were raised, you know, just being around people and literature and stuff like that, it's like we just gravitated towards that.
Yeah.
And I just remember there was the one table with the spotlight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
the Spotlight was a tabloid newspaper he published.
Yep.
Every week, about, what was it? How many pages had it to him? 50 pages? I mean, it was pretty good size. It wasn't just like one sheet. It was it was a newspaper.
Right.
Size of the National Enquirer.
Yeah.
Published every week.
Yeah, I just remember there was the Spotlight, and there was a guy behind it, and he had literature, and I remember, I don't, if I was with you, Dad, or Rachel, or Nathan, or somebody else, but I was there, you know, and walking down the long row of tables, and there was the spotlight, and I remember standing in front of it, and I would imagine probably I was with someone there, and everyone was talking, you know, and just looking at the spotlight, and I remember hearing Willis Cardinal's name about this is by Willis Cardinal, and that's the first memory I have of actually, remembering who Willis Cardinal was, the spotlight, you know, and that was back then, you know, and so it's just one of those things that very, very instrumental person. I mean, definitely was a mover and shaker, you know.
Well, that was like back during like the big farming crisis and stuff also, where there was like so many farmers through the Midwest, and they were having their
farm aid concerts.
A lot of them were having their whole annual yield seized by the government and the big,
hay mills.
They're saved in.
I want to call warehouses, and that's what they
silos.
Are. But
silos, yeah, you know,
grain silos.
Yeah. Anyway, different. There's a lot of turmoil going on at that time, and anyway, and of course the spotlight and the Populist Party very instrumental in trying to waken people up to the plight of the farmers and just how the government was really getting involved in being almost terroristic,
right?
And the banking infrastructure in the country being very dictatorial towards the farmers and stuff like that. Now most people don't care about the farmers anymore, but yet they're still feeding the nation.
And I'm sure that's probably part of that, because that was a very troubling times even for the farmers. Still is. That's when my first memory of hearing about Willis Cardinal and you know, the Spotlight publication. I think that's really, you know, it's someone that definitely should continually need to be honored and respected. But the fact that, you know, you and Rachel going up there and attending that funeral, I think to me that really shows a lot of honor just being allowed to attend a funeral that really was for family and friends. And really respect, you know. I think that really shows, you know, even though this is the Knights Roundtable, really shows the fact that how close the Knights have been to Willis Cardinal and the family, and basically showing the stability, you know, because all that plays an important part, you know?
Well, I mean, the Knights Party has longevity, and it has stability, and you know, Dad's been on the speaking circuit for years and close friends with, you know, so many different, you know, other leaders throughout the country and everything.
I mean, basically, they could have asked anybody else.
Yeah.
You know, but the fact that, you know, they asked.
Well, Dad's respected, you know.
Well, very much respected. You also, there was, I believe you also said, Papa Hercules.
Yeah.
Papa Hercules.
He's there, and he's from Greece.
It took us a while to figure out how to pronounce his name.
Right.
And I still haven't figured out how to spell
it. Heracles.
Still haven't figured out how to spell his name.
Yeah.
But Papa Heracles.
Heracles.
And what's interesting about it, when he spoke out here last year, whatever it was.
Yeah. Last Faith and Freedom Conference.
He mentioned that, he said, people asked me how the name Papa Heracles came from. And so it turned out that he was from Greece, and it turned out his grandfather and great-father, his name was Heracles. That was the name Heracles, but he was a priest, a Greek Orthodox priest. They can marry.
Right.
So the people might say, well, priest, how can they have kids? Well, Greek Orthodox, they can marry. So he was a Greek Orthodox priest, and so they called him Papa, you know, like father.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he became Papa Heracles. And that name stuck.
With the family.
Yeah, with the family. So now he is Papa Heracles. He's not a priest, but he is probably a great, great person.
Yeah.
And Papa Heracles. So it's an interesting story.
So
but he was there. Joe Fields was there, and from California, and hadn't seen him in a long time.
Yeah.
And other people were there. Julie Foster from the American Free Press office, of course, was there, and then some family from Elizabeth Carto's sister, nieces, and so forth. And
so,
yeah. So yeah, it was a sad occasion because he passed, but also an honorable occasion as well.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, when you guys went,
I was going to say something silly.
Oh, when you guys were able to pass out, you know, the Crusader at Congress, and legislative buildings and the mm-hmm. different offices.
Well,
were you able to actually have like one-on-one meetings with
them? No. Now, number of years,
I'm kind of doing it jokingly, though.
I understand. Well, a number of years ago, we were there, and we did actually see some of the congressmen and senators. This time, we just want to hit as many offices as possible.
Yeah.
So we basically walked in and handed to whoever was at the first desk.
Yeah.
then to the next.
It was, you know, very limited window that we had
there,
and we wanted to do some filming in the area also. Sure. And
so we didn't even try to speak to the congressmen and senators.
Right.
But I'm sure if they would have known.
They would have known, yeah.
Yeah, we would have... Bernie Sanders was gone.
So he was gone.
Couldn't talk to him.
Schumer? Chuck Schumer?
Chuck Schumer was available, you know.
Yeah.
So,
he probably had a warm reception with him.
Probably not.
Yeah.
Probably not. But nevertheless, we just, you know, met his
I thought it was interesting going down Pennsylvania Pennsylvania Avenue there was the, because like Dad, you were mentioning when we were driving down the street about Trump saying how he's going to be there on Pennsylvania Avenue no matter what, whether he's president or not. And there's his big new, you know... Trump Tower that he's working on building. And, I mean, huge, you know. But all the way down the whole side of it was a big, huge, probably, 12, 15 foot high. And then the whole length, you know, Trump, you know. Just Trump, you know, and... coming soon, Trump.
Yeah, so he's there.
He's there.
Back to the deal about the papers at the Congressional Building. Is I do want to point out that nobody sent out the Capitol Police to run us off.
Right.
And they didn't like look at the papers. Oh my goodness sakes! You know, call the Capitol Police. You know, nobody did that. We weren't hassled at all.
Right.
We weren't hassled at all.
All political parties. Go there and pass out literature and drop stuff off. So, you know, the Klan, we'll give this to the aide, you know, and that's it. It's not like, oh my gosh.
Yeah. Plus, these politicians, you know, they got to be careful. Who knows? They don't know how many people we represent.
Exactly. You know, so. Absolutely.
Anyway.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because the way the left wing talked with Trump gaining so much ground, the whole darn country's a bunch of
angry white voters,
yeah,
and they are.
Oh, absolutely.
And supposedly Trump's grandfather was in the Klan, so
yeah.
Anyway,
yeah. The people that are supporting Trump are angry white people,
right?
And they mentioned that TV numerous times. I'm sure you heard it. People listen to this. I'm sure have heard it, and it is truly. And you know, those people, their anger is not going to subside.
No, it's just going to keep on getting. Yeah. More and more. And even if he doesn't get elected,
People be even angrier.
Yeah,
you'll be angrier.
And but anyway, yeah, so that was Wednesday, going back to Rose Carter's funeral. That was Wednesday. And then...
While we're in Washington, D.C., we did see some white people.
Did you take any pictures?
We didn't take any pictures, but we did see some white people.
Wow.
And it pretty was amazing. We saw all kinds of Chinese or Asians. Yeah.
Very diversified.
Lots of diversity, lots of blacks, a lot of Asians, some that were indescribable.
Oh.
You weren't quite sure what they were.
All mixed up around.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they were totally mixed up. they had a lot of multicultural going on inside of them. You don't know what they were.
Yeah.
and then we did see a couple white people.
Wow.
So that was pretty impressive.
That is amazing.
Now, we went over to Willis Carter's deal, of course, they were all white.
They're all white.
But in D.C. itself, you know, it was nice to see.
Yeah.
But it was when we came back, when we pulled up to Springfield Airport to pay the ticket going out the door, you know, where the person taking parking.
Yeah.
I told Rachel, I said, I bet this is going to be a white person, you know, and sure enough it was. And the reason I pointed that out, because every other job of that type in the restaurants, in the airport, in toll booth, whatever, are always black. Mm-hmm. And because politicians talk about how I help, you know, bring 5,000 welfare mothers, help give them jobs. And I said, yeah, you took them away from 5,000 white guys, yeah. Women who had those jobs. You took them away from them and gave it to the welfare queen.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
Because I hear politicians all the time talk about all the people they helped get off welfare, helped them get jobs. You know,
yeah.
Well, yeah, whose jobs did they get?
Yeah, you're just replacing someone else's job.
Yeah,
I mean, that's all you're doing.
We hear people the illegal aliens come across. And of course, legal aliens is an issue also. But they say, well, they're coming here because they want to better their lives. Okay, that's true. But really what they come in here to get a job.
Right.
And whose job are they getting? They're getting your job.
Yeah. They're getting an American job.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I wonder how many of the reporters would be happy if those illegal aliens coming over to getting jobs as reporters.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
All the reporters at CBS and NBC and MSNBC and all that sort of stuff. You know? I'm sorry, we got Waldez over here. He's going to work cheaper than you, Matt Lauer. Yeah. I'm sorry, we paid you too much.
Well, and the thing is, it's actually happening. I mean, these reporters, I don't care if you're a white guy or a white woman. If you're white, as far as being a profession as a reporter, it's being scarce.
Your job is being
scarce. It really is, because they want to throw at some non-white. And especially if you're a Mexican, you can speak Spanish, because that's really the Spanish is the first language and English is the second.
Well, sure, they want their on-air talent to represent the local demographics, and as the local demographics change to not white, then, hey, sorry, but you don't represent anymore.
Right.
So.
I remember out in California years ago, I forget the guy's name, I want to say it, but I may have it wrong, so I won't. But there was a Republican congressman in California who 100% for immigration. He battled for immigration, needed immigration, all that sort of. That was his trademark. He battled for it. And the moment his district became majority Hispanic, it was so funny. He got voted out, and they voted a Mexican congresswoman.
Yeah.
Sanchez, her name was.
Yeah.
But so what happened? Well, yeah, well, you got it coming now. All your illegals you wanted to the country and all the immigrants you wanted, they voted you out the first opportunity they had.
Yeah.
And so I thought that was kind of funny.
Yeah, they're all sellout. Hillary Clinton out there in Nevada pandering to the, you know, all the Mexican workers and so forth. And they know exactly what they're doing. They're just trying to milk the system for as long as they can until they don't have an opportunity as a white person, and they know it.
Yeah.
So they're
it's
just
for
gonna,
economic yeah,
they're going to bank gain. What they can while the banking is good.
Right. Exactly. It's for
and
all for
retire
personal
retire to
gain.
Their summer house and leave all the regular white people to deal with the aftermath.
Right. Well, that's like that guy in South Africa. I think it was, I may have the name wrong, but it was de Klerk.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he is the one to help break down apartheid.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And after apartheid broke down, what did he do? He retired to some villa in Europe or somewhere. Mm-hmm. And
The president of South Africa.
Yeah.
De Klerk. Yeah.
So they'll betray the country.
Yeah.
Hillary's betraying the country. She don't care about the country. And I have to say, I don't know, people listen to this, they have all kinds of ideas on politics and so forth, and there's issues about Trump that we don't care about also, like everybody else. But, you know, for Trump, for people to say that Trump is just chasing his ego, is really mistaken, because he is putting a lot on the line. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's putting a lot, if he wanted to just chase his ego, he could have spent that money and gone to traditional political party route.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
You know, and put his money in, and he could have bought the ads, he could have been whatever.
Right.
Established Republican.
Yeah.
But the fact that he's come out so strong on issues that are so near and dear to the heart of angry white people.
Right.
Says a whole lot about him.
Well, yeah. Well, and the primary issue, you know, that he's been, you know, sounding the alarm on is the immigration, you know.
Right.
And I think it was the last debate, they were talking about immigration, you know, plans like that. And he said, we wouldn't be talking about immigration if it wasn't for me. Yeah, you know, absolutely. Nobody here wanted to talk about immigration. Nobody even used that as one of their talking points. It wasn't until I brought up immigration, continued to bring about immigration, and people were upset about the current immigration system, that everyone else started jumping on the bandwagon.
Yeah.
And that's true.
And it isn't that the other politicians haven't talked about it. And we've talked about it. Other politicians haven't talked about it, but because they didn't have the notoriety and the recognition and the money, they were able to be ignored and pushed off to the side.
Right.
And nobody could claim the forefront, claim the limelight.
Right.
You know.
Well, and of course, we're talking more about the presidential election.
Correct.
You know.
Yes.
On the local level, definitely there's been politicians that have talked about it. You know. But on your presidential election, none of the Republicans
they had everything in that neat little box.
Yeah, because their program is, well, let's just grant them amnesty and let's move on. That's their policy. That's
Their only thing that their only discussion or foray into the immigration issue is immigration reform, which is just a fancy word for, like you said, Jason, amnesty.
We don't need reform.
And
we already got laws.
A pathway to citizenship and
coming out of the shadows.
Let's fix the paperwork. Let's make it a better, easily transition for them, and which is all basically catering to the non-white Hispanic vote, which the GOP has been trying to do over the the last 10 years or so. They've totally ignored and are trying to ignore social issues. They want to ignore the abortion issue. They want to ignore the immigration issue. They want to ignore the deal about gay marriage and the anti-discrimination laws for against homosexuals. You know, they want to ignore all that stuff and just concentrate on the typical fiscal conservative deals, which unfortunately, some of it is good. I mean, businesses are too heavily regulated and things like that, but also they do have big business in their pocket, and they do have the global entities.
Well, this new trade deal, Asian deal, that's all to help most of the big corporations.
Right. And it's, and that, those type of issues is what's pushing the other half of the white electorate towards Bernie Sanders, because he is so, Trump is like huge on immigration, which is getting all your white people who are really concerned about that social issue. Then you get the other half of the white electorate, which is really strongly behind Sanders, who's really it's weird because really, in reality, the outcome is not anti-globalism, but on the surface, people think it is because he's tough on big business and wants to regulate banks and stuff like that. So he's getting a lot of working class type white support, but it's still two extremes that can be joined together into what we promote is sound fiscal policy and social concerns, which
and
is
a battle against international finance,
right? Which is why
Well, back
years down the road, I mean, we've got a winning ticket. I mean, we just really, really do.
Years ago, when they started pushing the North American Free Trade Agreement with Mexico, all the Republicans got behind it, all the Democrats got behind it, and we were saying it's not going to work. It's going to be good in the short term.
Yeah.
15, 20 years down the road, it's going to destroy our manufacturing base in this country because they can hire those Mexican laborers much cheaper than American laborer, and they can ship in free trade, and that is what happened. Our manufacturing base in this country has been totally sold out.
Yeah.
That's why Trump keeps talking about bringing the manufacturing jobs back home.
Right.
And then he, of course, recently with about Carrier air conditioners
going
to Mexico. There's been others gone to Mexico because they can import them under the free trade agreement. And that's exactly what has happened. We said it was going to happen like this 25 years ago. And we said it would take 15 or 20 years for it to catch up to us. It's here now. But how many people remember there was a Democrats and Republicans that joined together to destroy our manufacturing base in this country? And it was people like us, Willis Carr to American Free Press, The Spotlight, other people within the movement who said no, no, no. Ross Perot was big spokesman in that. No, no, no. It's going to look fancy and good now, but it's going to kill us 25 years down the road. And like Ross Perot said, what is everybody going to be doing? Cutting off chicken heads in Arkansas, or made right. some comment about
yeah, something like that.
He made some comment about chickens. You know,
yeah,
and that's the only kind of jobs our kids are going to have available to them.
Right.
Yeah. And then Bernie Sanders wants everybody to go to college.
Yeah.
Well, that only makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, not everybody wants to go to college.
Well, absolutely. And the thing is, you know, up until recently, you know, people didn't look down at blue collar workers. You know, right. they didn't look down at that manufacturing. But we
that was
we
a prestige. You got a good absolutely. Job. Absolutely. But
now,
hard,
now we have a...
And you retire at 55, 60 years right. old. They give you a gold watch and you got a pension and you...
Yeah.
Enjoy comfortably. Your retirement with yeah. your wife and...
But now we live in a day that, you have to go to college because of the fact that... Well, you can't be a manufacturer because there isn't no manufacturer. Yeah. So yours is going to have a degree and magically, whoosh, you have a job. Yeah. Well, no. You don't have a job, just you have a degree. There's millions of people that have degrees that are unemployed.
Working at McDonald's.
Yeah. And so you have to have that manufacturing base. The manufacturing base has always been the backbone of any country.
Yeah.
You know? And Donald Trump, yeah, he was talking about how the NAFTA and GATT and all that's just been devastating to America. And he was saying, you can't compete with China with cheap labor. There's just no way you can. Yeah. And so there's what are we going to do? Well... We're going to say...
Shut
it off. These corporations come back. If you don't want to come back, 30-40% tax you're going to have to pay if you want to ship your products in the United States. If you're going to punish the American workers, we're going to punish you.
Yeah.
You know? And that's the whole
reason... Yeah, but the American worker making $15, $20 an hour.
Right.
I don't care how good he is. He can't compete with somebody coming out of rice paddy making $1 an hour.
Right.
You can't do it.
And that's why trades and tariffs are actually a good thing. It actually is an equal playing field. Because if you have an American worker and they're selling a product for, let's say, $150, whatever that product is, and you're having some product made in China, they won't have cheap labor. Great. You're going to have it coming to the United States. You're going to have it sold at economically reasonable price as an American worker. No, the products. That's how he makes it equal, you know.
Now, free trade probably wouldn't hurt so much with countries that are as developed as ours. You know, maybe with England or Germany or something
right.
like that.
So much of your conservatives are against, they're against tariffs and so forth. And I know I was reading Ben Adams' book, which goes back like the 1800s time or 1700s, whatever. Someone may be able to correct me. But anyway, it's kind of like a hallmark of conservative economic policy and stuff like that. And he's, you know, very much against tariffs and how ultimately all it does is cause the prices for consumers to be raised and so forth. However, his entire discussion and everything is in relation to Great Britain and the United States and other European countries, which is, you're talking apples and apples, not apples and oranges, because we all have aspire to the same standard of living, and we have the same, basically the same culture, and the same type of work ethic, and so forth. And so, yeah, maybe not tariffs when you have an equal type beginning, but when you're dealing with China or India or Pakistan
Bangladesh or
places
Taiwan.
Like that, free trade doesn't work. And the racial issue it always comes down to a racial issue. And people, so many of your conservatives, they don't want to admit it, but it does. It doesn't matter if it's economics, if it's about school choice, whether it just doesn't matter. It always comes back to race. And that's just a foundational starting point of any type of discussion is race.
Well, because race, out of race comes culture, comes faith, comes ethics, comes values, standards of living. All those things come out of race. Culture comes out of race. People think that you can change a culture, then you change the outcome. You can't do that because culture is a product that comes out of people. People create a culture. Culture doesn't create people. And certainly there are areas in which environment changes people, help maybe give them better opportunities and so forth. So I'm not going to say the environment doesn't have some play in outcome, but it has very
it's
little
not
compared.
Overwhelming.
Not compared to nurture, the,
right.
What the people are. That is the heart and soul of a of people. From that comes a culture that is natural to them.
Right. Yeah. But anyway, the it always has to come back to race, and that you know our founding fathers understood that. That's why country was designed and organized for white people, and it worked. I mean, it's never been perfect. That's why they said toward a more perfect union. So it's never been perfect, but it's been the best that we've had, and it was for white people working together.
Well, the very, like you said, that I always, you know, make that statement that, you know, the very first Immigration Act in the United States limited immigration, or as a citizenship, I guess,
yeah.
To white Christians. I mean, to be a citizen in the United States, you had to be a white Christian.
Well, the thing is that there was, as I understand, there's 5 states that allowed non-whites to become citizens. And when we speak about non-whites in that day and age, we're talking about blacks. And possibly American Indians, the Muslims and Asians were minimal. They weren't even considered in their reasoning. But blacks
were not the fabric of American society.
No, they were not the fabric. But so there was 5 states that allowed a black to become citizen of their state, but they were not citizens of the United States. In other words, a black man, for instance, Maine was one of those states. A black person could be a citizen of Maine. Probably mainly in theory, because there probably no black people live up there. You know, so they're, oh yeah, a black one. You know, they were judging from lack of knowledge and experience. But Maine did allow blacks to become citizens. But if that black person who's a citizen of Maine, he could not just up and move to New York, as an example.
And retain his citizenship.
But a white person, no matter where they moved, their citizenship was all considered automatic. And that's why the Civil Rights Law was passed. Because we understood, the Founding Fathers understood, that our people were given unalienable rights, which were our rights coming from God. And the Civil Rights Laws are passed because up until that time, blacks were not considered to have the natural rights. And so the laws was passed to give them rights, and the rights came then, of course, from the government. But the black person, as an example, could move to another state. He's not retaining citizenship. And that's, of course, a whole part of the Dred Scott decision was based upon that. And so people might not like that. I'm quite confident that there may be even people who are listening and say, well, that's not fair, and I don't like that, and that Americans were prejudiced. And they come up with all those statements, but it doesn't change the fact that that's how the country is constructed. Non-whites could not be citizens of the United States, plain and simple.
Right.
And all the territories that were established all throughout the West, you know, Nebraska and Oregon and, you know, well, Idaho.
That's why I think when people, you know, talk, you know, you got kids, you know, talking about, you know, or even adults, because, you know, you're talking about the public educational system for the last 40, 50 years being tanked. But, you know, they are taught that America was just a great melting pot, that everyone was just, it was just open arms, you know, mm-hmm. was welcome here. It's just not true. If you anyone that is a student of history and investigates the history and looks at it and researches, can quickly find that America was not designed to be a great melting pot, as they like to say it all the time.
Right.
It was very restrictive. White Christians, I mean, non-whites cannot become citizens. I mean, just look, I mean, they talk about how it was a great melting pot. Well, just
read. Why did they have to pass all these laws?
Read the Declaration of Independence. You can see very quickly it was for white people. Yeah. I mean, they talk about all the Indians and the savages.
Yeah.
Obviously, they didn't think they were equal to them.
Yeah.
You know? And people might say, well, that's mean. Well, that's what the founding forefathers, the people at that time, thought.
Yeah, people could argue that it was mean. Okay, they can put an argument for that.
Right.
They can put an argument that isn't fair. They can put up an argument that is not nice. But they can't change the historical facts.
Right.
The country is founded as a white Christian country, period.
Exactly.
You know, Well, that's not fair. Well, maybe it's not, but that's still what it was. And but history, you know, like or George Orwell talks in his book about changing history, about like one line at a time, and rewriting history and changing words and so on. And in his book 1984, and kids today, they actually think that if the founding fathers established a country as a great melting pot of all races and cultures and ethnicities and religions and so forth, they just want a big conglomerate of the world.
Yeah.
And that's not at all, that is not what they envisioned. You know?
I mean, because like you said, if that was the case, they would have not had a pass, you know, the 14th and the 13th, 14th, the 15th Amendment. They would have not had a pass the Civil Rights Act in the 1960s. They would have not had to force, you know, the liberal Supreme Court justices to make decisions that was contrary to the founding forefathers' beliefs. And that's where states, you know, had the right to pass laws that best fitted for their own citizens. So if it was a great melting pot, then why was there such a proactive in trying to change the laws? Because the people did not want it. And the only reason you change laws to force the people to do something.
That's right.
That's the only reason.
You don't make laws to do something that everybody's already doing.
Right.
You know, like say, a new law has been passed. Everybody now has to breathe. You know, or there's a new law passed. Everybody has to sleep and get a night's sleep every night. You don't need to pass laws of something people are going to do automatically.
Right.
You know, you pass laws to force people to do something they would not naturally do. And so that's why they have red light. People would not stop at the traffic lights. They would just sit there. It would be like these crazy scenes you see sometimes in third world countries where traffic, everybody's just kind of going every which way. They don't know what's going on. Beep, 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 and everybody's going around.
Yeah.
And here we come, the orderly society. Like, here's the red light. You stop. I'm sorry. All right. I don't want to stop, but I will because I'll get a ticket if I don't.
Wait your turn.
Wait your turn. So you pass laws to have people do things you would not do naturally. For example, there's no, people find this strange, but there's no federal law against murder. There's no federal law. There's no, Congress has never passed a law against murder. It doesn't exist because it's considered natural law. You don't kill people.
Right.
You know, what there is judgments in state courts for murder.
Right.
But I don't know, does Arkansas have a law against murder or do they only have the punishment for murder?
They have a punishment for murder.
But they don't have a law against murder.
Yeah.
And so,
so you command murder, this is your punishment, you know?
Yeah. It's considered natural law.
Yeah. Command robbery, this is what you do. So, yeah.
And the same with interracial marriage. It was considered natural law. And so punishment started coming up in various states for those who did become engaged in interracial marriage. And then, of course, then some laws were passed to prevent that from happening. But natural law, you know, is something that is understood, and then, you know, people respond to it with punishment and so forth. And so there's no law against murder, but there's no judgment for murder. And so our founding fathers understood this to be a Christian country, a white country. The first immigration law passed in 1790, in March of 1790, restricted immigration to only white people, good moral character. Like I started to say a few moments ago, all the territories that were established all through the West up until the passage of the 14th and 15th Amendment, all the territories, Nebraska, Oregon, Idaho, the Dakotas, you name them all, every one, Arkansas, Missouri, everyone restricted citizenship to white people.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
You can whine and say it isn't nice. You know, you can whine and say it isn't fair, and that's still what they did.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I kind of like to change the subject a little bit, and I've talked just a few minutes before, because I know we have only about 10 minutes left, talk about our Faith and Freedom Conference that's coming up on April 29th, 30th, and May 1st. Now, Faith and Freedom Conference, again, this is a conference, I'd like to call it a retreat, a white Christian retreat, but it's really an event that anyone that's listening out there needs to attend, needs to make plans, And you have plenty of time to make plans. April 29th, 30th, May 1st. It's held at the Soldiers of the Cross Bible Camp, the Christian Revival Center. It's all on the same piece of property. And usually we start, you know, Friday evening about 5 or 6 o'clock, all day Saturday. And it's going to be all day Sunday this year. And we are going to have some great speakers here. A lot of great activities for the adults, for children, for teenagers. We always have a youth conference that coincides with the adults. So we have great activities. And then, like I said, we've got speakers. And a lot of kind of sometimes on this year is a little bit great because it's going to be kind of going down memory lane a little bit because it's your 50th wedding anniversary. You and Dad, you and Mom, 50th wedding anniversary plus 50 years that you were ordained as a minister in 1966, and so that's been 50 years. And so, you know, we're going to have no slides, and we have a nice dinner that evening. And so, it's going to be just a really great time. We just got confirmed. We announced this last week, I should say. William Johnson, of the American Freedom Party.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to be attending the conference. He's an international attorney out in California. So he's been.
Well, you interned for him.
I interned with him when I was in college.
He has office at World Trade Center.
In the World Trade Center.
Yeah. And so he's not yesterday below his hatch.
No. And definitely not. And he's been involved in the white nationalist fight, you know, for decades, you know. And again, it shows the stability of the Knights, you know. And last Faith and Freedom Conference in 2015, we had Willis Cardo. We had Dr. Ed Fields. We had Paul Fromm. We had Papa Hercules from Greece. So our conferences here are really not your dry and boring conference that you so often you see. It is at our campground. It's a really a white Christian retreat. It's not boring. We have music. We have entertainment. It's out in the country, obviously. We have usually, you know, sometimes we'll have an ice cream social. We have a bonfire in the evening time. Really just a relaxing atmosphere. We have a playground equipment for children. A lot of times teenagers, they go hiking because we have caves around here, hiking trail. There's places you can park your RV. If you have an RV, sometimes people have parked their RVs. So we have, you know, designated spots for that. So, I mean, really, it is a white Christian retreat. And it's vitally important people attend this conference, these type of conferences, especially here, because there's really not that many places you can go in the United States and go and bring your family, have a nice, relaxing atmosphere to be hearing great speakers, be entertained, your children enjoy it, and just feel that you don't have to be worried about your car getting stolen.
Spitting in your food.
Spitting your food. Conference is going to be canceled last minute. It's just a safe environment, a friendly environment. And it really is a retreat.
Yeah, and it's not like, you know, some, you know, and it's not like it's their fault. But, I mean, you know, Mom and Dad were very visionary in making sure, you know, now people have conferences and they're like, oh my gosh, I hope it doesn't get canceled at the last minute. The hotel is going to cancel this, our meeting hall and stuff like that. I mean, Mom and Dad saw that coming 30 years ago.
Yeah, it's like we need to have property.
We need to have our own secure place. Exactly. But anyway, but you know, the conference center here itself is very nice.
Right.
And it's not like the type of thing where, you know, okay, let's say you do take your family to a conference somewhere and it's in a conference room and it's all hush hush and you got to be real quiet. And so pretty much unfortunately the wife and the kids sit in the motel room while the guys in the conference room, or maybe they go down and swim in the pool for a little bit. And then they're like, well, okay, is Dad going to be done pretty soon? Oh, maybe it, you know,
right.
They have a lunch break at noon and,
right,
you know, type deal. This is a very fluid type environment, with, you know, great speakers and music, but also the type of atmosphere where kids can come and go. And
we encourage the children and the spouses to be sitting in the conference while the speakers. We love the idea that you have a mom in the back, you know, with her little baby, holding her baby, or sitting in the, you know, the table, you know, with a baby. We want that. We want the family.
What
there.
People really like is when all the kids come marching through, waving their flags.
Oh, absolutely. They love that. Yeah. And you see the, you know, children. That's one of the things we always do is have the children go through with, you know, with the flags, and just instilling upon them that they have a right to be proud of their culture and their heritage.
Yeah, and if you need to, and if you need to get up and stretch your legs, it's not any big deal. It's not like you're just going to go outside the door and be in a hotel hallway somewhere. You go out, step out of the room, and
sit by the pond.
And yeah,
watch the fish in the pond.
Yeah, and the water feature and the, you know, all the nice, kind of like a Cracker Barrel, have the rocking chairs out in front, you know, and nice seating and just a wonderful atmosphere. You might, you know,
you got a nursery right inside the church. So
nursery
the mothers
there for moms with infants and so forth, and the kids' corner where kids are busy doing crafts and little white heritage, you know, lessons that are all coordinated together, different crafts. And
we like people staying in the meeting, and most of them do. But every now and then somebody says, well, when the teenagers take the hike, can I hike with them? Sure. You hike
right,
with them.
Right.
Then they said, I didn't know hiking would be so long.
Well, and not only that, but we have cabins. We have a men's cabin, women's cabin for people that wants to stay out there. There's like no nominal fee or like around $10. We just purchased another cabin that we're going to have moved onto the property here in a few weeks. So we're always expanding on our church grounds. And
of course, that we haven't talked about the Christian Research Development Center.
Absolutely.
That thing is going to start hopping and popping here now that spring is here.
Yeah.
And so
when people are saying, what organization out there, what's actually doing something, you don't have to look very far.
You know, it's nice. I know some people within the movement get intrigued by those who they say get out on the streets and, you know, and
boots on the streets.
You know, and that's all good. That's all good.
Yeah,
We've done it.
We did 25 years of boots on the ground.
And we still have people that do that.
Yeah, so we're not against that. But at the same time, you got to build a foundation for the future.
Right.
You know, you can't just concentrate on running out and holding a rally and wave the flag and say, I've done my duty. And that is good. But at the same token, you got to build a foundation for
the
future.
Which is a long, grueling work.
And
not very glamorous, and not always, as you know, going out, boots on the ground, waving your flag. That's fun and kind of entertaining.
Right.
But then, weekend's over.
Right.
Now what?
Well, and that's the thing is because those
step two?
Right. Rallies, passing out literature. The only purpose of that is trying to get the message out. That is the only purpose of that.
Right.
And it is entertaining. Oh yeah, pass out literature. And we have associates all across the United States that do that. That's one of the things we do promote. But just to say that's all we do, passing out literature, it's kind of a thrill. You know, pass out literature, you did something. Okay, and that's it. But again, it's just for more promotional purposes to pass out literature, get your name out. Internet has changed all that, but even with the internet, you still have to have a foundation. And that foundation has to consist of offices, conferences, centers, a place where people can come and meet. If you're looking at long-term strategy, that's vitally important.
Yeah.
You have to have that.
Like Richard said, you got to have step two.
Step two. And people, they take the first step and that's it.
Yeah.
Okay. That's it.
And it's good. We don't knock it at all. You know, but individuals need to understand that this is a long, drawn, generational battle.
Right.
Right. Rather than planning what's happening next weekend or this summer, we're planning what's happening in 20 years.
Yeah, we have to have a vision for 20 years.
You know, and the balkanization that's occurring.
I'm going to interrupt, Rachel, because that was what's so exciting about this youth corps.
Right.
And we're going to close it up. I want to talk about the youth corps real quickly, because we're getting these young kids coming in, and they're catching the vision.
Oh, well, that's what ties in with the development center.
Yeah, they're catching the vision. That is some old codgers out there, they think, oh, the battle is, it's hopeless. I'm not going to get anywhere. Young kids are catching the vision. Oh. They see a future. You know, they don't see the future out here in the world, but they see a future here with the Knights and a recommitment to the cause of Christ, of loving your God, loving your people, moving forward. They're just catching the vision.
Well, you know, with the youth corps, you know, we have the youth corps crusaders, and these are teenagers that we're constantly getting, people are joining constantly, you know. And, you know, we just last week, you know, not all of them, but we've had a few that have joined from Pennsylvania. A couple of that joined from Pennsylvania. We've had one that joined from New York. That's just three of the ones that have joined. We've had a lot more.
Well, I mean, I remember those three because you, and you don't have them with you.
But I
remember you reading the piece. Listen to this guy from Pennsylvania, what he wrote on his deal. I can't remember what it was, but it was so inspiring. You had to call me up on the phones, and I've got to read you what this guy wrote. You know? And he was excited about first time he's I've scanned over the internet and I looked over stuff and I see a lot of people out there that are upset, but he said, I see hope.
Absolutely.
I see stuff I can actually get involved
in.
There's
a plan
and
do. An action.
You know, they're not going to sacrifice my security by using me just by putting me out on the street where I might, but give me a vision of what I can do
long-term.
In my career, by developing my college education, perhaps, you know, and not everyone is in college, but maybe some going to the old private businesses or have a vision of that. But they're seeing what they can do in long term with themselves, with their future wife or husband, and with their families on what they can do to help provide a future. These young kids aren't even married yet.
Yeah.
And they're always talking about wanting to provide a future for their children.
Exactly. Well, what's exciting about these kids that are joining the youth corps is they're not pessimistic at all.
Right.
They see the problem and every one that joined is, what can I do to solve this problem? What can I do to get this word out? What can I do to help steer the direction towards us? You know, it's not like, well, yeah, we're going to hell and like depressed. They're energetic. They want to do something. They're not the one I called you about. He's like, what can I do to get on social media to change the way we talk to other kids? We have one kid, I believe from California or Texas. I can't remember. He's the president of his political club in his high school. You know? I mean, so you got these kids that are very energetic, people that we're looking at long-term strategy now that 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now are going to be the movers and shakers. If they already are energetic, they see what's happening in the United States and they want to change that, and they're coming to us, and if we can give them on the right path, steer them in the right direction.
Get them through the development center, train them,
the academy, and the youth corps. Then these are people that are going to be our future leaders, you know. And that's a long-term strategy. This is not what we're talking about next week or next month. These are kids that are wanting to do something. And so they're going to be in their individual states. And we don't know what's going to be developed out of them, but these kids are joining, and we're getting a lot of them joining. I mean, it's a massive amount.
Yeah,
I want to say too that if we were just like Jerry Falwell, well, he's passed away, but okay, Liberty University or Jimmy Swag or something, we could put these images, put these kids, show these kids on TV or show them on the internet and show their smiling little faces and tell them what they care about, and interview them, talk about their love of our people, all this sort of thing. Because those are universities, those people, Jimmy, they're kind of accepted by the establishment.
Right.
We're not going to sacrifice the images of our kids that hook up with us.
Well, definitely.
And so we kind of have a handicap in that. Because we can't take some young girl or some young guy who's a freshman in college who wants to pursue a career and expose them to all his colleagues.
Say, here's their testimony. This is why you need to send the biggest check you can into the development center so we can continue their training so they can not only be a doctor or an attorney in their hometown, but they can also have some sway over.
But we can't put their pictures on
affairs, right.
We can't put their possibly be limited what they can do.
Yeah.
So we have that handicap. But I want to close off right now. But I want to say this: is that if anybody really cares about a country and cares about these kids and the future they can, they need to get behind this movement. They need to get behind our development. They need to get behind our cause. Their children are going to, your children are going to suffer the same consequences as everybody else's children.
Right.
You're not going to escape it. If you're somebody, if you're a CEO with a massive corporation, if you have a wealthy income, your wealth is not going to protect your children.
Well, and right now, this time of year, a lot of people are getting their state and federal tax refunds. Use a portion of that for the development center. Send that in, you know, and because some people know they might get $1,000, $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, you know, depending on their income. There's no reason, realistically, there's no reason you can't send $1,000 or $2,000 if you're getting a $5,000 or $6,000 tax refund. There's no reason. I mean, it just depends how important is your future and your race. It comes down to that. If it's not that important, I guess you won't be sending anything.
Yeah,
you know, but don't gripe and complain about right. What's happening.
And then pick up that little baby of yours, look him straight in the eye, and say, "You know what? Your future's not important to me.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. I'm gonna buy me a new Lexus.
Yeah, I don't care about you. Yeah.
Anyway, we gotta close it up. Anything else?
Just Faith Freedom Conference, vitally important. Please attend that and continue watching our programs. We have a lot of great programs on KKK Radio. So search the world every day. We have new programs being put on the air, so continue doing that.
Yep, absolutely. Well, until next time, this is Thomas Robb.
Jason Robb.
Rachel Pendergraft.
Reminding you to love your God and love your people.